Some slaves in fields, said Douglas, cautiously glanced at us through the post and rail fences. Fear spread like the fastest wind when slave rebellions or runaways were thwarted. The eye contact Frederick may have managed with his fellow slaves only made the mutual dread more contagious. Upon arrival, after hours of travel, the coffle was untied and interrogated. Frederick had urged the others to deny everything, like the fledging revolutionaries they had tried to be. Own nothing, had been their leader's command while on the march. They were placed in the stone jailhouse on the rear of the Talbot County Courthouse, which still stands today. Behind heavy locks, bars, and iron latticework on the windows, for the first week of captivity, the prisoners bonded again in their assumed fate, sail separately to the deep south. They peered through the windows, wishing they could speak to one of the white-coated black waiters across the street at Solomon Lowe's hotel. Like a pack of fiends fresh from perdition, slave traders, eager for new flesh for the southern markets, lurked about the jail, taunting the prisoners and feeling their arms, legs, and shoulders to judge their fitness. This constituted the Eastern Shore's active domestic slave trade, about to feed four new pieces of property down its trough, greased with filthy lucre. Later, Douglas did not miss a beat in using these daily encounters with slave traders to show that, however much detested by polite society in the slave South, these whiskey-bloated gamblers in human flesh were necessary to the master class's profit and expansion. The slave owner and the slave trader, declared Douglas, were partners in blasphemy and blood. At the end of that first week in jail, Freeland and Hambleton arrived to extract the other three young men and take them back to their farms without any punishment. In this dreaded separation from his friends, Fred Bailey felt a solitary desolation. As ringleader, he now felt certain Auld would at any time arrive to sell him to Alabama or Georgia. For seven more lonely days, Frederick fended off the probing hands and the insults of the traders, and felt a volcano of rage and a numbing loneliness rising in him. When his tense and indecisive owner finally showed up, to Frederick's great surprise, Auld had decided not to sell his slave, but to send him back to Baltimore with the promise that, for good behavior and learning a trade, Auld would free him on his 25th birthday. This moment may easily have been the greatest stroke of good luck in Douglas's life, and he seems to have known it. Auld could have sent him into the very Everglades of Florida, wrote Douglas of this turning point, beyond the remotest hope of emancipation, and his refusal to exercise that power must be set down to his credit. After many weeks of deadly mischief, of hope sublime and fear unbearable, the wretched imprisonment and humiliation, Fred Bailey must have found a little skip in his step as he realized he would once again see those clipper ships in Baltimore Harbor. Why did Thomas Auld send Frederick back to Baltimore at age 18? How or why did he resist the $800 or more he might have pocketed on the sale of his slave to the Cotton Kingdom? Certainly his wife, Rowena, who detested Frederick, would have craved the money from the young rebel's sale. The Freelands could now view Frederick only as dangerous and would have wanted him out of the neighborhood. And William Hambleton, Auld's own father-in-law, apparently told Auld in no uncertain terms that he would shoot the young man if he was not sold out of Talbot County. Douglas later learned from his cousin, Tom Bailey, that Auld fretted a great deal over his decision and walked the floor nearly all night before going to the Easton jail to retrieve Frederick. Perhaps his Christian conversion and a personal disdain for the vulture-like slave traders at the Easton jail played some role, as well, in Auld's choice. According to Douglas, Auld blustered for a day or two back in St. Michael's that he had an Alabama friend to whom he planned to sell Frederick. But the fictitious Alabamian never showed up. Auld may have hoped that as Frederick learned a trade, profits might be made from his labor in Baltimore. But it also appears that, emotionally, Auld whether because of extended family blood ties, or out of watching this brilliant young rascal grow up for 18 years, just could not bring himself to sell Frederick to a doomed fate. Ault had done Fred Bailey an extraordinarily good turn. It would be a long time before Frederick Douglass would fairly recognize the deed. Frederick had left Baltimore 3 years earlier as an awkward, despondent, long-legged boy. He returned in 1836, an approximately 6'1", well-built young man, firm and strengthened by more than 2 years as a field hand, and, above all, more confident in mind and body. To Frederick, Baltimore was warmly familiar at first, but also greatly changed. The turbulent, increasingly violent city teemed with huge numbers of new Irish immigrant laborers. The free black population had rapidly risen to more than 15,000, with an active community of churches and associations, while slaves numbered only just under 4,000. The Aulds had moved to Fells Street, just past the Shakespeare Alley, but still near the burgeoning docks and shipyards. Hugh's fortunes had eroded. He lost his own shipbuilding firm and was now working as a foreman in another yard. Grown to near manhood, Tommy Ault had gone to sea as a sailor aboard a brig called the Tweed, never to be seen again. To bring in wages for himself and to teach the slave a trade as a caulker, Hugh Ault hired out Frederick to William Gardner's shipyard, where the big builder employed at least 100 men on breakneck schedules to fulfill a contract to construct 2 men of war for the Mexican government. The Gardner Yard was an exciting and dangerous place. Most of the carpenters were white, some were free blacks, and among the apprentices running about frantically at the beck and call of the older workers, Frederick may have been the only black. With all manner of racist taunts, white carpenters barked orders at Frederick. "Fred, come carry this timber yonder. Fred, bring that roller here. Fred, run and bring me a cold chisel." All day long, the young man tried to answer to "Halloo, nigger," and "Say, darky," while doing every nasty job at an impossible pace. For 8 months, wrote Douglass, this provided the school in which he learned the trade of caulker. In this ugly racial atmosphere, and with Frederick now hardly willing to back down to anyone, the young white apprentices turned on him. The niggers, they said within his hearing, were taking white men's jobs and should be banished. One day Frederick snapped after being cursed at by a large white fellow named Edward North. Frederick grabbed the white worker, wrestled him to a dock, and threw him in the water. Now a street fighter of necessity, and perhaps some relish, Douglass later claimed he could handle any of these toughs singly. But he also found more mischief than he had bargained for. While pounding bolts into the hold of a ship, one bent, and a white worker named Ned immediately next to him shouted that it was Fred's fault. Fred took offense and blamed the white man. The two of them each grabbed weapons. Ned, an adze, an arc-bladed hand axe, and Fred, a maul. And after lunging at each other with vicious intent, they suddenly stopped before one of them ended up dead. One day, 4 of the white apprentices, whom Douglass later named Ned North, Ned Hayes, Bill Stewart, and Tom Humphreys, pounced on him with a brick and a heavy hand spike. They beat him to the ground, and one of them landed a savage kick to his face, smashing his left eye, which for a time seemed to have burst my eyeball. With Frederick bloodied all over, his eyes swollen closed, the group seemed satisfied. But he staggered to his feet, and waving a handspike, ran after them as they fled. When Frederick limped home to the Alds' house, they met him with sympathy and outrage at his accidents. Sophia cried and tenderly nursed his wounds. The following day, the enraged Hugh took Frederick to a justice of the peace to seek redress and arrests of the young men who had beaten his slave. But Esquire Watson could do nothing, he reported, without white witnesses. By law in Maryland, no black person could testify against a white person. Ault tended to follow the strictures of the slave codes, but in this case, he fruitlessly protested. Douglas placed his memory of this event in a larger story of the new murderous spirit of Baltimore. The city no longer provided a place of cosmopolitan dreams for a slave, especially since at least 50 white men had watched his beating, lifting no hand to stop it, as they shouted, "Kill the nigger." When, less than 6 years later, we find Douglas tilting under the weighted strictures of his fellow abolitionists' pacifism, we need only remember these bloody Baltimore fights and his experience in the pro-slavery criminal justice system to understand his ambivalence. A brawler of necessity, he would ultimately find philosophical nonviolence untenable. Hugh removed Frederick from Gardner's for his safety and got him work at Price's shipyard, where Auld was himself a foreman. There, Frederick would learn well the craft of caulker and begin to take in from $6 to $9 per week. In this hothouse atmosphere of violence, racism, and embittered economic competition among an insecure working class, Frederick Bailey learned even deeper lessons about the natural struggle between labor and capital. In Bondage and Freedom, Douglas gave the economics of urban slavery and Southern race relations in astute analysis. Despite that thuggish white dock workers had beaten and nearly killed him, Douglas keenly grasped the plight of the white poor. "In their craftiness," wrote Douglas, "urban slaveholders and shipyard owners forged an enmity of the poor laboring white man against the blacks, forcing an embittered scramble for diminished wages, and rendering the white worker as much a slave as the black slave himself. Both were plundered, and by the same plunderer. The white slave and the black slave were both robbed, one by a single master, and the other by the entire slave system." The slaveholding class exploited the lethal tools of racism to convince the burgeoning immigrant poor, said Douglas, that slavery is the only power that can prevent the laboring white man from falling to the level of the slave's poverty and degradation. Douglas imagined a time when white and black carpenters had worked peacefully side by side in Fell Point's shipyards. He wrongly predicted that all these injurious consequences, sowed by the master class, would one day inspire the white non-slaveholding poor to rise in solidarity with slaves. As later in his career, Douglas's economic analysis could alternate between astute and naive, but he certainly understood class consciousness. With historical distance, Douglas found sincere sympathy for those poor white workers who had pummeled and kicked him. But back in 1837 to 38, trying to garner wages as a hired slave, he kept his fists clenched. His stories have become so iconic today that the scene has even appeared in a major work of literature, Sea of Poppies, 2008, by Amitav Ghosh. Ghosh tells an epic tale of a ship, the Ibis, built originally in Gardner's shipyard in Baltimore and used in the illegal slave trade, heading out around the Horn of Africa for a voyage into the Indian Ocean. Aboard is a young seaman, a mulatto-American freedman named Zachary Reed. After months at sea and much sickness and death among the crew, Zachary's mind travels aback across the oceans to his last day at Gardner's shipyard in Baltimore. He sees again a face with a burst eyeball, the scalp torn open where a handspike had landed, the dark skin slick with blood. In his vision, Zachary sees the encirclement of Freddie Douglas, set upon by four white carpenters. He remembered the howls, "Kill him. Kill the damned nigger." He recalled how he and the other free black workers had held back, their hands stayed by fear. Zachary hears Freddie's voice in his head, not reproaching them, his fellow black workers, for not coming to his defense, but urging them to leave, scatter. "It's about jobs. The whites won't work with you, freeman or slave. Keeping you out is their way of saving their bread." It was then, says Ghosh, that Zachary quit the shipyard and went to sea. In 1837, Freddie was still yearning to get out of those shipyards himself. In the relative safety of Price's shipyard, Frederick found better days in 1837 and 1838. He began to read again, and most important, he joined in the life of the large free black community of Baltimore, especially a debating and social organization, the East Baltimore Mental Improvement Society. Here, Frederick could let down his guard and employ his favorite weapons, words, and the growing charisma he cultivated while using them. He was living among freemen, he recollected, and resented every aspect of his slave status against the lives of his free friends, especially the necessity of depositing most of his wages with Hugh Auld every Saturday night. Frederick chafed under such brutal contradictions. At 19 and soon 20 years old, his future made no sense to him. "Why should I be a slave?" he recalled thinking. "There was no reason why I should be in the thrall of any man." Frederick made fast friends among a new band of brothers, especially five, James Mingo, William E. Lloyd, William Chester, Joseph Lewis, and Henry Rolls. Sometimes they met in Mingo's old frame house in Happy Alley and debated racial, religious, and political issues. One of them, Lloyd, wrote to Douglas in 1870, remembering that one night Frederick waxed so excited with his oratory that, "You told me you never meant to stop until you got into the United States Senate." Fred Bailey's speaking career began first on Freeland's farm, and then in Happy Alley in Baltimore. At one of the social gatherings of the Debating Society, or perhaps as likely at the Sharp Street AME Church, which Frederick joined, he met a young, dark-skinned free woman who liked music, named Anna Murray. Anna was born in or around 1813, near Denton in Caroline County, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore, within 3 miles or so of where Frederick was born. Their childhoods may have overlapped for a year or so in this region known as the Tuckahoe Neck. They knew each other's families, although Anna's had been more intact, and they had played at the same mill and wandered as kids in and out of Hillsboro. Anna was the seventh of 12 children born to Bambara and Mary Murray, both slaves. But because of the manumission of her mother, Anna was the first born free. At age 17, likely in 1830 or 1831, while Fred Bailey was 12 or 13 and living with Hugh and Sophia Auld, reading the Bible with Father Lawson and combing through his Columbian Orator, Anna, with three siblings, Elizabeth, Philip, and Charlotte, moved to Baltimore to find work and a better life than what the right bank of the Tuckahoe offered. For 2 years, Anna found employment as a housekeeper for a French family named Montel. Then, perhaps for as long as 5 years, she served the family of Mr. Wells, the postmaster of Baltimore, who lived on South Caroline Street, only a half dozen or so blocks straight above Philpott and Thames, where Frederick lived during his years in the city. Dressed likely in a drab white or gray calico dress and apron by day, Anna may have donned a special headscarf and a prettier dress on whatever day or evening she met the strapping 19 or 20-year-old brainy slave from the Eastern Shore. They may have known each other simply from passing in the streets, but when they met, they must have fallen into a long, smiling conversation about where they were from, the people they knew, each other's cousins, and stories of growing up along the Tuckahoe. Finding Frederick was not the only reason Anna had moved to Baltimore as a teenager, but she surely must have thought so now. And Bailey, perhaps still a bit awkward around young women, must have craved Anna's admiration, emotional support, and adoring eye contact. She was older, had lived in this free black community for years, and perhaps gave the young slave some credibility among his new friends. She may have even provided caring advice on how to take care of his injuries and scars from the rumbles down on the docks. Somewhere between Caroline and Thames streets, the two fell in love and discovered they needed each other. Douglas had found a woman who would help him imagine a new life. Anna worked for her meager wages for the Wells family and as part of a burgeoning group of free black women struggling for domestic service positions in white people's homes. Anna did manage to save some money and owned two feather beds and other household goods when she became engaged to Frederick. But her daily life was a battle against poverty, paying rent for her lodging, buying firewood, always striving to be the efficient and prim housekeeper the Wells family expected. In her 20s, she was one lonely worker who, as historian Seth Rockman aptly wrote, scraped by on the economy of makeshift. Frederick needed a helpmeet with whom to dream and plan his way out of Maryland, and Anna needed a future that might not include carrying white people's chamber pots every morning. Frederick absolutely hated Hugh Auld's right of the robber in taking the slave's earnings. Here, Frederick was again, now 20 years old, treated as a boy serving the ends of white people who still owned his body and his labor. His troubles, he maintained, as ever, were less physical than mental. Remembering these last months of his time in Baltimore, Douglas penned another gem about the psychology of slave and master. To make a contented slave, you must make a thoughtless one. It is necessary to darken his moral and mental vision, and as far as possible, to annihilate his power of reason. The slave must know no higher law than his master's will. If there be one crevice through which a single drop can fall, it will certainly rust off the slave's chains. Frederick's chains had long since rusted into powder, and a mental and pecuniary tug of war now ensued between Auld and his slave that forced the young man to a desperate flight for freedom. In the spring of 1838, Frederick and Hugh made a deal, allowing the slave to take his own lodgings, hire his own time, and keep any wages above $3 per week. From May until August 1838, Frederick worked hard, bought his own caulking tools, and forged more personal time to, perhaps under Anna's influence, take up music at church. Above all, work itself now seemed to equate with liberty. Until Frederick went to a camp meeting one Saturday night, some 12 miles from Baltimore, and having a grand time, stayed until Monday, thus missing his payment time, Saturday night, by 48 hours. Upon his return, Auld was furious, threatened to whip the grown man, and accused him of plotting to run away. The owner rescinded Frederick's partial freedom. He could no longer hire himself and keep part of his wages. Sulking for at least a week, Frederick refused to go to work at all. Auld, in his fury, verbally abused the lad, threatened beatings, and even sale. With genuine fear that Hugh and Thomas Auld might indeed finally sell him south, Frederick and Anna, with the assistance of other free black friends, hatched his escape plot. Over the next 3 weeks, Frederick worked hard down at the yards so as to dispel Auld's suspicion of a scheme. On one Saturday, the spiteful master took Frederick's $9 and gave him back a puny 25 cents. Between the two of them, Frederick and Anna pooled resources to buy him a real train ticket, as well as the symbolic fare, as he wrote, on the Underground Railroad. His plan required cunning, courage, and luck, not to mention Anna's own devil-may-care bravery and material support. According to family lore, Anna sold one of her feather beds to raise cash for Frederick's journey. With a terrible sense of internal excitement and anxiety, the pain of separation from the only friends he possessed, and memories welling up from the Freeland Farm debacle of 2 years earlier, Frederick searched for someone's free papers to use at various checkpoints. A friend from Fells Point, a retired black sailor named Stanley, provided the young man with his sailor's protection, a remarkable document never to be forgotten with an American eagle at the top of the page. Nothing was fail-safe, and a cautious person would never have attempted this plot. Frederick obtained clothing to present himself in full sailor style, red shirt and a tarpaulin hat and black cravat, tied in sailor fashion, carelessly and loosely about my neck. It would be quite a performance. He knew the language of ships and sea, and declared himself ready to talk sailor like an old salt. On the appointed day, Monday, September 3rd, 1838, Frederick went to work early, then met Anna on the way to the Wilmington and Baltimore train station, just a few blocks above the city dock. With tears and an embrace, Anna sent her sailor boy pacing back and forth near the waiting train. So that he would not have to face the scrutiny of a ticket window, Frederick had arranged for his friend and drayman, Isaac Rolls, to bring Frederick's baggage along just as the train started moving. The boy from the Bend and the Tuckahoe jumped on the crowded Negro car and began the most famous escape in the annals of American slavery. With excited fear, Anna retreated to a workday at the Wells house and to several days of anguished waiting for some sign of the good word. What could she have thought? He will make it to a place far north called New York. He will go all the way to Canada, to worlds way beyond the horizons of Chesapeake Bay. I, too, will ride that train to join him somewhere. I will never see him again. He will be returned within the day in ropes and chains, bloodied, soon to be shipped south and out of my life. She, too, had her bags packed. Controlling her outward emotions, even eating and sleeping, must have seemed impossible. She probably prayed in all her quiet moments. As the train churned toward Havre-de-Grace, Maryland, a distance of 37 miles to where the Susquehanna River empties into the top of Chesapeake Bay, Frederick encountered his first danger. The gruff conductor meandered through the car, checking tickets and documents. The sailor, Stanley, was much darker in complexion than the mulatto, Fred Bailey, but softened in the face of such a young sailor, for whom Douglas maintained there was widespread social respect. The conductor barely glanced at that eagle on his document, and the fugitive's sudden terror subsided. At Havre-de-Grace, passengers boarded a ferry to cross the Susquehanna. Frederick had to do his nervous best to shake a young black boat worker who kept up a steady questioning of the well-attired sailor's origins and destinations. Now, for approximately another 37 miles, half through Maryland and half through Delaware, slave states, the train trudged on. Minutes were hours, and hours were days, Douglas recalled of his drama. The heart of no fox or deer, with hungry hounds on his trail, said the autobiographer, had ever beat more anxiously or noisily. At a stop, Frederick looked out his window, and immediately next to him, in the opposite window of a train heading in the other direction, was a ship's captain named McGowan, on whose revenue cutter the young caulker had just worked the week before. He knew McGowan would recognize him, but the captain never turned his head or made eye contact. Then Douglas encountered a German blacksmith he knew from the Baltimore shipyards, who looked him over knowingly, but thankfully had no heart to betray me. At Wilmington, Delaware, Frederick coyly, if rapidly, walked through town from the train station to the wharf, where he boarded a steamboat that soon set out into the broad and beautiful Delaware River. Arriving in Philadelphia in late afternoon, after 30 unmolested miles on the steamer, Frederick walked off the gangplank onto free soil for the first time. He wasted no time in relishing the moment and asked the first safe-looking black man he saw how to find the train to New York. Directed to the Willow Street station, Edward Covey's broken bondsman paid the fare and took the night train up through New Jersey to the Hudson River landing and railroad terminus in Hoboken. There, around sunrise on Tuesday, September 4th, Frederick boarded a ferry that chugged southeasterly across the mighty Hudson River to a dock at the end of Chambers Street. On a bright September morning, with the sounds of snapping waves and the shouts of men's voices along the wharves, Harriet Bailey's lost orphan stepped into the busy streets of New York, wide-eyed, thrilled, and frightened. Douglas later struggled for those magical words to describe his feelings that special morning. Walking amid the hurrying throng and gazing upon the dazzling wonders of Broadway, he felt the sensation of a free state around me and a free earth under my feet. What a moment was this to me. A whole year was pressed into a single day. A new world burst upon my agitated vision. But these sensations stymied this eventual wordmaster, he admitted. They were too intense and too rapid for words. He later managed a little poetry nonetheless. Anguish and grief, like darkness and rain, may be described, but joy and gladness, like the rainbow of promise, defy alike the pen and pencil. Although he was careful about whom to speak to in those dangerous streets, he remembered words from inside his soul like a shout. I was a free man, and the voice of peace and joy thrilled my heart. On that morning, the words swirling in his head would have been the frightened fragments of a fugitive, eyes darting this way and that, wondering which impulse to trust. It took some years in the development of his genius with language for Douglas to shape this and many other parts of his story into the tale of the ascendant barefoot slave boy who would go forth and change the world. Hungry and friendless, Frederick soon realized he still stood in an enemy's land and had no time for odes to joy. In reality, Fred Bailey had escaped Maryland slavery with extraordinary bravery, but now he was a disoriented fugitive without any real plan. Numbed by loneliness, he trusted no one. Every white man appeared as a potential kidnapper, and every black man a possible betrayer. He felt like everyone's prey in the great metropolis. Later in his career, as he portrayed over and over for abolitionist audiences the experience of the panting fugitive, he knew exactly of what he spoke. For at least one and possibly two nights, Frederick slept among the barrels at the wharf. By day, he encountered a fellow fugitive he recognized from Baltimore, known in slavery as Allender's Jake. Jake warned Frederick at length about ever-present slave catchers. Then he met a black sailor named Stewart, to whom he entrusted his story, and by whom he was directed to the house of David Ruggles on 36 Lispinard Street, at the corner of Church Street, a mere 4 or 5 blocks from the wharves. This was good fortune to rank alongside the day Thomas Auld decided to send his slave back to Baltimore at age 18. Ruggles was a free black grocer, abolitionist, newspaper editor, and especially the leader of the New York Vigilance Committee, the organization that openly and clandestinely aided fugitive slaves within and through New York City. From his house, Ruggles edited The Mirror of Liberty, America's first black-owned and operated magazine, which printed reports of the Vigilance Committee's legal and illegal work on behalf of runaway slaves. In his house, he also maintained an essentially public reading room, with anti-slavery books and newspapers aplenty. Ruggles, who was just then in and out of court, and for a time under arrest for his role in advocating for a Virginia fugitive, Thomas Hughes, who had accompanied his owner, John P. Darg, to New York, found time to take the ragged Frederick under his roof and guidance. Here in Ruggles's reading room, amid the roiling controversy over the life and future of a fellow fugitive, and even at the courtroom where Frederick attended and witnessed his host's testimony, the Maryland slave first encountered the exciting and dangerous daily world of abolitionism. Frederick spent at least a full week sheltered at Ruggles's house. In some idle moment, his host suggested a speedy name change, and like so many other runaways seeking anonymity, Frederick decided to become Frederick Johnson. That name would last only for several days until his later arrival in New Bedford, Massachusetts, where he would take the name Douglas. Most important, as quickly as possible, Frederick wrote a letter to Anna in Baltimore, which Ruggles mailed for him. The letter, in a prearrangement, was likely addressed to one of the good friends Frederick had made in the debating society, who quickly, on or about September 10th, rushed to Anna, who could not read, with the news that she was to take the train as soon as possible to New York. No one ever recorded or told the story of Anna's brave train and steamer journey, also done in 24 hours, leaving the only environments she had ever known, abandoning her paying job to join her lonely, directionless fiancé to attempt to make a life somewhere up north. But away she went. And according to her daughter, Rosetta, among the household goods she carried in a trunk was a plum-colored silk dress that 3 days after her arrival on September 15th she wore to be married to Frederick Johnson in the small parlor of Ruggles's home. To conduct the wedding, Ruggles invited the Reverend James W.C. Pennington, who had himself escaped from slavery near Rockland, Maryland in 1827, when, like Frederick, he was 20 years old. Born James Pembroke, he had run overland and found shelter with Quakers in Adams County, Pennsylvania, before moving on to New York and Connecticut. Like other fugitives, he had changed his name, and after working as a blacksmith, he became a minister, pastoring both Congregational and Presbyterian churches in New Haven, Connecticut, and Brooklyn, New York. Like Frederick, his residence as a city slave had led to his desire to seek learning and freedom. Pennington had vigorously sought admission to classes at the Yale Divinity School, only to be rejected. James and Frederick had much to discuss, although it was wedding day, but Douglas left no account of conversations between the two fugitive slaves. Pennington left Mr. and Mrs. Johnson with a short certificate of their marriage, the text of which Douglas reprinted in the narrative, as though he needed to display an official declaration of such a human and liberating act as marriage on free soil. Sensing that Frederick had no plan other than some vague idea of going to Canada, Ruggles firmly urged the newlyweds to move up the New England coast to New Bedford, Massachusetts, a whaling port, where Frederick could find work as a caulker, and the couple would find a welcoming fugitive slave and free black community. Ruggles gave Frederick a $5 bill, and with no further ceremony, Douglas tells us he lifted the larger part of their luggage, which contained his beloved Columbian Orator and three song booklets, on his shoulder, while Anna carried the smaller bags, and they strode across Lower Manhattan to the docks to embark on the steamer John W. Richmond. Full of gratitude for David Ruggles, that whole-souled man fully imbued with a love of his afflicted and hunted people, Frederick had quickly and happily gone from teacher to pupil. Two strong and courageous black abolitionists had shown him the way. Holding his intrepid bride's hand, Frederick stepped beyond 3 years of bloody and beautiful mischief into freedom. Chapter 6. Living a New Life. Yes, the world's a ship on its passage out, and not a voyage complete, and the pulpit is its prow. Herman Melville, Moby Dick, 1851. Frederick Bailey had found his passage out, and Frederick Douglass now searched for a pulpit. By mid-September 1838, when Frederick and Anna arrived in New Bedford, Massachusetts, they had wrenchingly experienced what Douglass would later call the Upper Ground Railroad, and what the world came to call the Underground Railroad. They had escaped slave territory to free soil by their own remarkable bravery, but they had also benefited immensely from the clandestine efforts of David Ruggles and a small network of people to whom Ruggles had referred the newlyweds. Still trusting nearly no one, the anxious fugitives were now armed with at least one letter of introduction, as well as other names. After taking the steamer to Newport, Rhode Island, Frederick and Anna rode a stage up the coast into Massachusetts and arrived exhausted and penniless in the whaling port. In New Bedford, they were directed immediately to the home of the free blacks Nathan and Mary Johnson at 21 7th Street. The Johnsons took them into their three-story wood-framed house for the night, paid their stage fare, and welcomed Frederick and Anna as they had many such fugitives before. Nathan Johnson's origins are not fully known, but he had been involved in creating the growing black community in New Bedford and in assisting fugitive slaves since at least 1822. At breakfast on the morning after Frederick and Anna's arrival, Johnson urged the Marylanders to choose a new name. Too many Johnsons had resided among the fugitive slaves of New Bedford, as well as in the broader North, said Nathan. Indeed, of the 23 Johnsons listed as head of households in the New Bedford Town Directory for 1839, 12 were labeled C for colored. In his remembrances, Douglas gives no role to Anna in this decision. He tells us that he gave his host the privilege of choosing his new last name, but that he dearly wanted to retain Frederick. "I must hold on to that to preserve a sense of my identity," wrote Douglas in 1845. Johnson had just been reading Sir Walter Scott's Lady of the Lake, the classic and popular romantic Scottish poem of 1810. From the Highlander clan named Douglas, Johnson suggested a new name. Frederick liked the name's sound and strength as a word, and he quickly accepted, adding an S for distinction. Thus began the long process of the most famous self-creation of an African-American identity in American history. In both its simplicity and its literary gravitas, Scott was wildly popular in America. Douglas wore his new name with increasing pride. Remembering this choice of new name in Bondage and Freedom, he referred to his two original middle names, Augustus Washington, given by his mother, as pretentious. As the literary historian Robert Steptoe has remarked, Douglas's sloughing off of his two middle names and the choice of the new surname provided him a kind of ritual cleansing of some of his slave baggage at this special moment in his new beginning. With retrospect, Douglas sighed that any fugitive slave had to adopt various names during his escape to survive because, among honest men, an honest man may well be content with one name, but toward fugitives, Americans are not honest. And by 1855, he had long since read Lady of the Lake and was glad to be associated with the great Scottish chief, although he acknowledged that his New Bedford benefactor, Nathan Johnson, might better represent the military virtues of Scott's Highlander hero. "Had any slave catcher entered his, Johnson's, domicile," wrote Douglas, "with a view to molest any one of his household, he would have shown himself like him of the stalwart hand." This passage is really about Douglas himself, who had learned and practiced repeatedly by the mid-1850s the virtues and perils of protecting and transporting fugitive slaves. He does not tell us just how he incorporated his new name into his sense of self during his first years of relative obscurity in New Bedford. But with time, he had clearly breathed some of Scott's language into his soul. He wanted to be viewed by his many audiences, till whispers rose among the throng. That heart so free and hand so strong must to the Douglas blood belong. Douglas eventually developed, above all, a literary identity, a man of words spoken and written. The New Bedford in which Douglas landed in 1838 had a population of nearly 12,000, perhaps as many as 300 of whom were fugitive slaves among a free black population approaching 1,000. It was as open and thriving a refuge for runaways as anywhere in the North, and it was a booming whaling center, with some 170 ships making it their main port and employing as many as 4,000 hands. In the year just before Douglas arrived, the town had some 17 candle houses and oil manufactories. Of the 181,724 barrels of sperm oil and 219,138 of whale oil imported into the United States in 1837, more than 40% of the totals came in at New Bedford's docks. Within the ensuing decade, down to 1849, whaling became the first international industry dominated by the United States, with New Bedford as its capital. By 1840, in New Bedford, with a population of 12,087, the whaling business grossed $7,230,000. Douglas himself would never go to sea as a whaler, although the crews of so many ill-fated ships were one place where blacks and Indians and all manner of young boys and men could find work. Like Baltimore, the sea at New Bedford brought the world into Douglas's vision, and the whale as a product made an economy in which he would find wage labor of all kinds for 3 years. As Herman Melville put it in Moby Dick, the crews with whom he served and fought and mutinied on whale ships came from all the isles of the sea and all the ends of the earth. From his residence in New Bedford, at the very time Douglas also lived there, Melville left unforgettable descriptions of the town. New Bedford, he wrote, is a queer place, full of an almost infinite eccentricity of types and behaviors among the young mates of the whale fishery, of a variety of wild specimens from the hills of New England and the farthest isles of distant oceans. In his own way, Douglas was another wild specimen come to join this teeming seaport, and now he needed a job. From his years in Baltimore, Douglas knew much of the world of ships, seaports, the maritime trades, and especially of the men and women who lived by the wealth of the sea. But the body of the whale had for several decades built New Bedford and forged jobs for a young fugitive slave. Until the discovery of petroleum in Pennsylvania in 1859, which rapidly killed off the whaling business, the whale helped launch the modern industrial revolution. Its oil used for all manner of lighting, its hairy bristles made into brooms, its bones transformed into everything from canes to umbrellas, its pearly spermaceti made into the best candles, and even a foul black liquid from its gut somehow converted into perfume. Douglas's autobiographical writing about New Bedford served different ends than Melville's. It took its place in his anti-slavery polemic, drawing sharp distinctions between a Southern slave society and a Northern free labor society. Yet, it was often no less lyrical than Melville's descriptions of the town. Many have speculated, though no one knows, whether Melville and Douglas somehow met or observed each other in New Bedford. They were both there in late 1840 and early 1841. The sailor adventurer was preparing for his long voyage to the South Seas on a whaler, while the fugitive slave worked as a day laborer. Douglas admitted that the wealth and grandeur of New Bedford surprised him. He had been conditioned to consider slavery as the basis of wealth, not in the whaling port. Working white men and black men alike owned homes and lived with dignity. Douglas seemed genuinely stunned at Yankee enterprise and apparent prosperity. Contrasting the poverty and degradation of poor whites in Baltimore and St. Michael's with the superior mental character of Northern workers, he used as his example Nathan Johnson. Douglas's host, though a working man, lived in a better house, dined at a richer board, was the owner of more books, the reader of more newspapers, was more conversant with the social and political condition of this nation and the world than 9/10 of all the slaveholders of Talbot County, Maryland. Johnson, Douglas contended, labored with his hands in New Bedford, was the worker citizen, even an intellectual in this seaside free labor community. Douglas also remembered that he felt safe in New Bedford, in part because the town contained so many Quakers, with their egalitarian and enterprising traditions. During his residence in the town, whaling seemed to be a commerce with an endless future. At the wharves, he insisted, were industry without bustle, labor without noise, and heavy toil without the whip. For the young Douglas, all things before his eyes were in stark contrast to the slavery-ridden world from which he had fled. In the town's many whale-related enterprises, he maintained, everything went on as smoothly as the works of a well-adjusted machine. The excited man in his early 20s was impressed with all the modern conveniences he encountered. Wood houses, indoor pumps, sinks, drains, self-shutting gates, washing machines, pounding barrels. Such observations vary widely from Melville's characterizations of the hard-drinking harpooners and other lost souls at the Spouter Inn and other stops along the streets of New Bedford. That wise prudence guided the sensibilities of this town would have seemed strange news to many of the young men seeking adventure and fortune on those whalers in the 1840s. But Douglas was aiming for different places. Within 3 days of arrival in New Bedford, Frederick found paid work loading oil casks onto a sloop bound for New York. He soon sought to use his trade as a caulker, but the white caulkers of the docks threatened to walk off their jobs if the young black man was hired. All was not so prudent or liberating after all. But in this case, Douglas swallowed his pride and anger, put away his caulking mallet for now, and took every kind of job he found. One day he walked up to a prosperous house, knocked on the door, and asked the lady if he might put away her load of coal. As she dropped two silver dollars in his hand at the end of his dirty work, Douglas remembered, "It swelled my heart as I clasped this money, realizing that I had no master, that my hands were my own." For 3 years, and for honest money, he said, he sawed wood, dug cellars, shoveled coal, swept chimneys, rolled oil casks to the wharves, helped to load and unload vessels, worked in Richardson's Candle Works, in Richmond's Brass Foundry, and elsewhere. He also worked as a waiter for a prominent attorney, and did all manner of odd jobs for a local minister, Ephraim Peabody. A reminiscence, later, by a Peabody family member, described how Douglas became a man of all work at the minister's house, though much more inclined, it is said, to sit on the kitchen table and read than to work with his hands. The Peabody descendant reported that Douglas defended his inactivity by affirming that he occupied his leisure hours by pursuing the study of French. At the foundry, Douglas characteristically tried to read while he did the hot and dirty job of working the bellows. With little time for mental improvement, he recalled in 1851, "I often nailed a newspaper to the post near my bellows and read while I was performing my up and down motion of the heavy beam by which the bellows was inflated and discharged." In old age, he marveled that he could have been so earnest in pursuing knowledge as a young man while having to struggle to feed his family. Anna gave birth to their daughter Rosetta on June 24, 1839, and their first son Louis on October 9, 1840. Douglas does not tell us in the autobiographies about the circumstances or joys of these births. He only indicates how he worked with his calloused hands to support his wife, who was unable to work, and a growing family in two rented rooms. They lived first at the rear of 157 Elm Street, on the west edge of the main town, and after Louis was born, at 111 Race Street, only a few blocks from the wharves. Frustratingly, Douglas wrote next to nothing of his domestic life throughout his long experience as an autobiographer. In these 3 years in New Bedford, what we do know is that he found work and stayed out of debt. In rapturous excitement at working freely for wages and gaining some independence, Douglas believed he was now living in a new world. Soon, the day laborer looked for a church. Perhaps he was thinking of his children's spiritual welfare, or even Anna's lack of community. But as always, in the autobiographies, the story was only about himself. At this juncture of 1839 to 40, he admitted he had never given up, in reality, his religious faith. He considered himself in a backslidden state in his early 20s. The young man was looking for a pulpit, one he could listen to, and perhaps one he could step into. Father Lawson's faith still tugged at Douglas's spirit, and the stories and cadences of the Bible slumbered fitfully in his memory. He had grown up around Methodists on the Eastern Shore, many of them the hypocritical masters he used as a foil for resistance. Out of familiarity, he felt a duty to try to join the Elm Street Methodist Church. Douglas attended the primarily white church, but found himself proscribed and not allowed to sit in the main pews. A dozen or so blacks attended and sat in a gallery. Staying for Holy Communion, he witnessed the ritual with mortification. As the Reverend Bonney finished serving all the white members, he called the blacks forward with a voice to an unnatural pitch. "His black sheep," said Douglas, "seemed penned slavish souls." Douglas walked out the back door of this humiliating scene. Douglas quickly found his way to the welcoming arms of the small black congregation of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, pastored first by the Reverend William Sarrington, and then by the Reverend Thomas James, who had himself been born a slave in 1804 in upstate New York. In 1839, Douglas served as sexton, steward, class leader, clerk, and local preacher in this humble congregation that met in a little schoolhouse on 2nd Street, only 3 blocks uphill from the wharves. He also performed weekly duties as the church's Sunday school superintendent, responsible for the education of members. The Reverend James later claimed that Douglas, who was right out of slavery, had been given authority to act as an exhorter at the church just before James's arrival. The Reverend said he then licensed Douglas to preach, which Douglas later confirmed. Douglas remembered his deep associations with what he always called Little Zion as precious and among the happiest days of my life. He expressed firm opinions on which of the church's ministers were most effective or possessed education. He said he occupied the pulpit when the minister asked, and dozens of times Douglas held forth on Sunday mornings or at evening gatherings. In a letter near the end of his life, written in December 1894, Douglas reminisced with joy about how the little AMEZ church in New Bedford had offered his first chance to exercise my gifts and launched him in his new vocation. In the 1841 town directory, Douglas's occupation had changed from laborer to reverend. No recorded remarks survive from Douglas's sermons to the small church of fugitive slaves and free blacks. By at least the summer of 1840, though, earlier than scholars have previously known, Douglas was discovered by white abolitionists. In August of that year, the Boston anti-slavery lawyer Ellis Gray Loring wrote to a friend in Toronto, the Reverend Hiram Wilson, excitedly telling of a colored man we are anxious to employ as a lecturer. His name was Fred, and he had been owned by Thomas Auld of Talbot County, Maryland. The stunning young fugitive had escaped 2 years ago. He was a light mulatto, tall, well-formed, of an open countenance, and speaks very good English. Loring enlisted Wilson to be an agent to Auld to try to buy Douglas's freedom. Fred is poor and a laborer, Loring wrote, but his speaking skills could produce great effect. Nothing came of this early initiative to purchase Douglas's freedom, but the day laborer did not hide from view, especially on Sundays. The young father, with his wife at home caring for 2 babies, must have frequently taken time in his workday life to consult his Bible, his Columbian Orator, and his vivid memory of the band of brothers at the Freeland farm as he prepared for his mornings in the pulpit. The former Sabbath school leader among slaves seized upon his liberty and his new calling like a miner finding gold. At least by 1840, and perhaps as early as 1839, he registered to vote by paying his $1.50 poll tax. In Massachusetts, in the late 1830s, men, including blacks, registered to vote by paying this small annual tax. In the sweep of America's racist and discriminatory history with voting rights, it is remarkable that the most famous black man of the 19th century, shortly after escaping from slavery, while living with a new, assumed name, with no other identification, and certainly no proof of birth in the United States, and while still illegal as a fugitive from Southern justice and the property rights of his owner, could instantly become a voter by paying $1.50 and having his name placed on the tax rolls. Approximately 4 months after his arrival in New Bedford, Douglas also encountered an agent for William Lloyd Garrison's abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator. The paper and its editor changed Douglas's life forever. The young fugitive was too poor to pay for a subscription at first, but the agent nevertheless had the weekly sent to him. In The Liberator, Douglas started reading an anti-slavery voice like no other. Garrison seemed prophetic, revelatory, like a Moses raised up by God to deliver his modern Israel from bondage. So clear, radical, and uncompromising, Garrison's words seemed to Douglas like a gospel full of holy fire. The paper, Douglas wrote in 1855, took its place with me next to the Bible. Here, he found moral suasion. the appeal to reform the hearts of people before changing the laws of a society. For the young reader,